This is episode 22 of Photo Geek Weekly. Thank you so much for listening. I am here with a man that I've known for many years, and we've actually had very few conversations. So I've been looking forward to this, to dig into the geekiest topics that I could drum up for the week. And because this was NAB show, there was a lot of cinema-related news. And well, photographers might not be entirely interested in all the minutiae of cinema. There's some pretty fun stuff here that really should grab our attention. So to go over these topics with me, I have the one and only Bruce Clark. Bruce, how you doing?
Hey, Don, I am fantastic. I don't know if I'm the one and only. I think there's another Bruce Clark out there, because when I tried to get BruceClark.com years ago, there was some guy that already had it. So curses.
Ah, well. Well, you know, even there is another Don Komarechka out there. In fact, I'm named after him. He's my grandfather.
Oh, well, I'm named after my dad, and he's also Bruce Clark. So there you go. That's also another.
All right, Bruce, what is new and exciting with you? What have you been up to lately?
Oh, what have I been up to lately? Well, my wife and I just got back from Japan. I had lived in Japan for a couple of years, about 20 years ago, and I'd been meaning to go back. My wife had never been, and it was cherry blossom season. And so we had some extra Aeroplan miles that we wanted to get rid of before Aeroplan goes away. You, as a fellow Canadian, I'm sure is familiar with Aeroplan, which is kind of Air Canada's loyalty program. And it's in the future of it is uncertain. So I said, well, let's burn off some miles and go to Japan. Perfect time to go over there and catch cherry blossom season. So we just got back from there for a couple of weeks. We did a little tour of Tokyo and then a few other areas around Japan.
And how was the weather when you came back to Edmonton?
Sucky. Winter has not left yet. We're supposed to get more snow. I don't know what's going on. So the winter has been put, the installation of spring has been put on hold.
I know. We've got cherry blossoms in Toronto, just south of me. We actually have a cherry tree in our backyard that'll give me something to look at and enjoy. But it was snowing yesterday, and this coming weekend, we have a major ice storm predicted that will likely knock out the power in my city. So,
oh, fun.
Yeah, that's great.
Like to photograph snow, so...
Yeah, I'm done with it for the year. Honestly, there is a point where you have to just say, enough is enough. You know, we've got snowdrops and crocuses and other flowers that are coming up and blooming. And I really want to switch gears into this spring stuff, but it's just not happening, at least not for another week or two.
Yeah.
But... Yeah. I hope your trip was productive to Japan. Was it just for sightseeing and tourism?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. And caught up with a few friends while I was over there as well. I still have some friends that keeping in touch with, and actually some friends from Edmonton who I worked with in Edmonton. He married a girl from Japan. They happened to be there at the same time visiting her family. And so we actually managed to meet up with them for lunch one day. And cool. While they were there as well, they were coming back home to Edmonton too. So it was kind of funny. There was all these people there at the same time. And then two other photographers that I know from Canmore happened to be in Japan. I don't know if you know Lanny and Erica from Two Man Studios. If you've
I heard don't,
of them
before. But they're wedding photographers. What a coincidence.
And they were actually there one day behind us because I saw their stories on Insta stories, and they were in Osaka the day after we were there. And I was like, what? So it was kind of funny. All these people seemed to be there at the same time.
Hey, cherry blossom season, you're bound to run into foreigners. You know, you get a lot of tourism around that.
It was busy.
But back home here in Canada, you know, you mentioned sort of that you are a photographer, or that you know other wedding photographers, and you're in that circle. What kind of photographer are you?
Primarily weddings is a big chunk of what we do. That's probably 60% of how I spend my time is photographing weddings. But obviously, you know, it's a seasonal business, particularly here in Canada, although people are embracing winter weddings more than they used to. So we're you know, it's spread out a little more than it used to be throughout the year. But for the most part, our busy season is kind of coming up here, kind of May through until about September, October. That's kind of when it's peak kind of. And then obviously, you know, June, July, August are always sort of the busiest months for us as wedding photographers. So that's 60% of my time. And then the other half of it, or you know, third of it, is a bit of commercial work, of live events, corporate work, headshots, portraits, you know, and then some, you know, some family stuff sprinkled in.
Yeah.
But predominantly weddings, and then corporate stuff and events and things like that. So
cool. Now, just out of curiosity, because I mean, I'm not in the wedding photographer circle at all. What is your typical turnaround time from taking the pictures to delivering them to the customer? Because I know that varies quite heavily depending on the industry, how busy people are, and you know, oftentimes the time of the year.
Yeah. I mean, we set the expectations with our clients that they're gonna see their images in 4 to 6 weeks. And then our internal goal, or my internal goal, is to get those done in under 3. So we're kind of, you know, over under promising, over delivering. Is that the way? That's the way it goes, right? Not over promising, under delivering. You don't want to do that way. That's not good for business. So, yeah, usually about 3 weeks. You know, if they happen to catch us at the beginning of wedding seasons, it might even be a little bit quicker than that, just because, you know, if we don't have a lot of weddings.
Once you get overlapping, you know, you're shooting a wedding every weekend, sometimes, you know, even two a weekend.
Yep.
And it's easy to say, okay, well, now I've got however many thousands of photographs to go through. Oh boy.
Yeah. So yeah, August typically then that's when we're pushing. So we give ourselves a little bit of wiggle room. We say 4 to 6 weeks, that gives us some wiggle room. But last year we did 18 weddings and I delivered them all 3 weeks or less. So I was quite happy with that. So I've got my editing and my workflow down now pretty good. I haven't taken to outsourcing. I know a lot of wedding photographers who've kind of done that route where they've outsourced the editing.
And I've heard some people have some nice success with that, mm-hmm. but I think I'm kind of like you. These photos are kind of my baby. Mm-hmm. It's my art. And there are ways to absolutely make your process more efficient and, you know, to kind of create initial presets to start the editing flow and consistency across a particular shoot, and then modify and go in and fine tune from there. That's a creative vision that maybe you could train somebody else to emulate very, very accurately. Yeah. But I don't know. Maybe I'll try it at some point. But my work is not a large series of the same event sort of thing. So I don't think that's something I'm going to put on my radar anytime soon.
Yeah. I've had different reviews from people who've said, you know, sometimes it's good for them. Sometimes they've had to spend more time just reworking somebody else's work too. But other people have really, you know, found a good, you know, a good fit, and it's worked well for them. And they're able to use that time to do other things that they would either rather be doing, or, you know, building their business or working on the, you know, getting new clients and doing that kind of stuff that's revenue generating, and they're fine paying somebody else, you know, $20 or $30 an hour or whatever it works out to edit their photos for them. So,
well, I mean, one of the things that I offer as one of my services that I don't do a lot of, but I'll edit people's images, you know, and I charge, you know, a good amount of money. I'm not going to be the same rate as an editor in India or anything. Mm-hmm. But if anybody has a very specific, like, oddball infrared photograph or something that they just want my expertise in the obscure processes to really make it shine, then I'm more than happy to do that. But at one point, somebody brought me some images that they needed to rescue. They were from a wedding, their wedding, but the photographer did such an absolutely horrible job editing. Like, imagine editing a wedding photograph in MS Paint. You know, I mean, it wasn't paint. You could tell it was Photoshop, but they just did like a hard polygonal lasso on somebody's face and used an archaic sharpening technique with no feathering. Ooh. And it was just like almost impossible to fix and to even dial it back to the original. And I begged and pleaded with the customer to say, hey, you know what? You have to go to your photographer. You have to get the original files. And they sent back files and said, okay, here are the originals. They were the same files. Mm. The photographer might have copied over the originals and was left with just this absolutely horrible garbage mess that was very costly for them to have properly cleaned up and fixed, just to get back to a sense of normalcy without the editing. Yeah, it was brutal. Ugh.
Did they say kind of what they had initially spent, or did they do their research on?
I didn't ask. If they wanted to give me that information, then that's fine. But it was hard enough on them, and I did suggest, you know, your photographer has underdelivered here. Yeah. You should talk to them about your arrangement.
There's a lot of I find there's a lot more camera owners out there than there are photographers. Particularly in the wedding space these days, I know here in Edmonton, in our market, the market's pretty crowded and pretty saturated, and there's plenty of great photographers, but there are also a lot of people who own cameras.
Exactly.
Which is not the same thing.
Well, and you know, you get what you pay for in terms of wedding photography. You know, when we had our wedding, it was a couple of $1,000, and we had a second shooter, and there were more expensive packages, but you know, I figured this is what we needed. I have my own print studio. I didn't need to order prints or anything like that. I can handle that. We just made sure that was in the contract that I could do it. You know, be wary of the $500 or the $1,000 mm-hmm. wedding photographer, because they're trying to undercut the market and come in at a lower rate. But you know, some people have the business wherewithal to price themselves the same as other photographers, even though they don't necessarily have the skill set to do that. So, you know, what I've told people in the past is to talk to their clients, talk to somebody that they shot a wedding for, that if you can find them on Facebook, make sure there's no familiar relationship. You know, it's not like their cousin or their, you know, sister or something like that, that's always going to give them a glowing review. And just do a little bit of research. It's going to pay dividends in the end.
And ask to see some whole weddings as well, not just, you know, portfolio. Sure, people can go, people go to styled shoots and workshops and things like that, and they can build a portfolio that looks like they're, you know, they know what they're doing. But when the rubber hits the road and it's actually, you know, time to perform under the stress and time of a wedding day, that's a whole different ball game.
Exactly. Right, so. And I've second shot weddings before. I never want to do what you do, Bruce. I mean, sometimes it's not bad. It's not that difficult. But, you know, you don't know when you're going to end up with Bridezilla or the mother of Bridezilla. And that's just the kind of stress in situ that I don't need in my life. I'm happy enough to play around with flowers and bugs.
It's not definitely not for everybody, right? Some people really enjoy it, and some people, no thanks. I'm like that with like newborn. If it's gonna spit up on me or pee on me, I'm not probably gonna photograph it. So
unless it was your own.
Yeah, which we don't have other than animals. So, yeah.
Right. Okay. So let's, thanks for the great discussion to start this off. But we got some fun topics to talk about. And the first one today really came out of left field for me. I didn't see this one coming. Blackmagic Design has announced a pocket cinema camera, shoots 4K video. And the article on F-Stoppers says superlative features. And if you really dive into at least what they've presented to us in terms of the feature set, it is most definitely superlative. It's a Micro Four Thirds size sensor. So, you know, it kind of fits in that same range of camera as a GH5 or a GH5S in terms of, you know, a camera geared with cinematic intent. But the similarities kind of diverge at that point, because this camera is, it is a powerhouse of cinema. You can see that it's got XLR jacks on the side. It's got recording modes that, you know, they don't specify the very fastest mode, but it will shoot 4K RAW. And it does it internally onto a CFast memory card. There's more specifics here. Maybe you can get into a few of them that caught your attention, Bruce, but is this a game changer for you?
I mean, I'm not a big video guy at this stage. It's something that I've started to dabble in a little bit. It's definitely, discovering that it's a whole other world of technical stuff to learn about. And when we thought photography was technical, wow, you get into the video world, and there, you know, I read some of these specs and some of these terms, and I'm like, I don't understand half this. That makes my head explode. There's so many, you know, things on the, you know, bells and whistles on these things. But, you know, one of the things, definitely the price point jumped out at me for what this, you know, for what this camera can do. Obviously it's not out yet, so it's hard to give something a full, you know, assessment when it's not out, and there's no real world kind of reviews of it yet that I've seen. It caught my eye that it takes the Canon LP batteries, which is
I thought that was a little bit unusual. I mean, I know that there are external monitors and battery packs, and it's somewhat of a universal standard, but I don't know of any non-Canon camera that's used it. Apparently, Canon licenses the ability to do that, so why reinvent the wheel here? Now, we're burying the lead, though, on price, and I kind of did that deliberately, but if you compare this camera to features of the Panasonic GH5S, it's a bigger camera, mind you, and it's got a very large 16:9 touchscreen that kind of encompasses the entire back of the camera. So it is a different beast. It looks less tactile. Like, it doesn't have as many knobs and dials and buttons to have an immediate feel mechanically of the camera. But it is priced in at $1,295. Now, in comparison, the GH5S is pretty much twice the price at $2,500. And that is just astounding. Because, you know, I know a lot of people are talking about the GH5S and absolutely love it. If you're getting into video and you're serious about it, that's a great option. But if this camera can perform better in some ways, you know, it's got the options for multiple memory card formats and, 4K RAW shooting right in the device at up to 60 frames per second, no less. I just, I, How mm-hmm. are they getting this at this price point? Does that mean that Panasonic is making profit hand over fist, or are they bringing this in as almost a loss leader to just kind of snap up this market and not make a whole lot of profit on it, but entrench a user base that is currently looking for products just like this and build up brand loyalty?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, definitely the price point was, you know, obviously one of the first things that kind of jumped out. Like you say, compared to, say, you know, a camera like the GH5 or the GH5S, I mean, you could pick up, you know, two or three of these, you know, for the same price. I think somebody in the comments on the article mentioned, like, you could have a camera A, camera B, and camera C, you know, set up for the same price that it would cost you just to get one of these other cameras. So certainly that's quite, you know, interesting. Just looking at it, the form factor, it reminded me of the Lytro camera a little bit, in terms of like
look, it did kind of
that, and side profile look was kind of reminded me of it for a second.
How'd that work out for Lytro?
I not so good.
I hope that doesn't turn people off of this particular camera. But you know, I'm looking at, even in the first picture on this F-Stoppers article, they're recording video straight to a portable SSD. Mm-hmm. Right, so it's not just the SD cards or the CFast memory cards. You can record to external SSDs as well. The top, instead of having a hot shoe mount, it has a tripod screw on the top. So that's, I'm assuming that you could mount that. I'm sure there's one on the bottom too, but mount extra accessories and mm-hmm. devices. It's meant to be the center of a system mm-hmm. That, you know, as cinematographers often do, you see these videos where they say, oh, we shot an iPhone. Great, sure. The iPhone is the core of some gargantuan apparatus surrounding it. And so maybe the simplicity here is just when you're looking at this as a core device. But man, this is interesting. Again, it's not going to be out until September mm-hmm. of this year. So we're kind of oohing and aahing over specs that are not necessarily even complete. We don't know the exact sensor that it's using. A lot of details are simply being inferred. It will have a dual ISO feature, ISO 400 and 3200. It will have a windowed HD mode, which is probably cropped in for its high speed mm-hmm. mode. So, you know, there are certain things that they can't do everything perfectly, at least not at this price point, but 13 stops of dynamic range isn't bad for, you know, $1,200 when you're shooting 4K RAW, especially with that RAW availability. It really improves the capability in post-processing for those that are eager to get the best mm-hmm. out of their video. So, you know, I've got a point and shoot here on my desk, the Panasonic GH9, and it's shooting 4K. The Canon, was it the EOS M50, now does 4K and a smaller form factor. So this is becoming commonplace. Pretty much every camera out there is going to be shooting 4K video, but nothing quite like this. So to me, at that price point, it's really tempting to just buy that as a behind the scenes or studio mm-hmm. camera. I don't need to have the ones that have all, like the red cameras as a brain that has all of these different modules that attach to it and a serious investment in cash. Mm-hmm. If I were to be recording tutorials and sort of workshop, video workshops and that sort of stuff, and I want to get the best results, this camera looks like it's got everything that one would mm-hmm. need, especially if you already have an investment in the Micro Four Thirds platform. But to be honest, I've got a bunch of EF lenses mm-hmm. and Micro Four Thirds is infinitely adaptable to every other lens format, especially for video when autofocus or manual controls are preferred when you're trying to get the most out of it there. So I think this is a paradigm shift. I think this is a really important thing for people to keep an eye on, because it's going to set the tone for every other company making similar devices.
It definitely pushes the market, and it's going to force, you know, competitors to kind of take a close look at this and say, you know, what can we come out with, right? And, you know, competition is always good for it, for any industry, except wedding photography. You don't want to be competitive there, no.
No, but, go
but
away, yeah, please.
But every other industry, perfect. We're buying gear, perfect.
Well, the competition is never as good for the manufacturers or the retailers, or in your case, you are the person that is selling mm-hmm. the service. But competition would be good for your customers. It's always good for the end consumer. This is fun. I like what I'm seeing, and more power to them for coming out with something that might not be that innovative as a product per se, but that price point just jumps out at me as something that is shocking.
Yeah.
Now, what's interesting here, and a tie-in to the next story to be talking about, is this camera uses both SD cards, and they're getting really fast these days, and CFast. And my current camera, my 1DX Mark II, uses CFast cards, and they get up to around 550 megabytes a second, which is really fast. You know, I don't see myself needing more than that for the kind of stuff that I do. But if you are shooting 4K video at, say, 120 frames per second, or you're shooting 8K video and doing it in RAW or at very high bit rates, you might need to go even further than that. CFast is pretty much limited at that speed. It's not going to get faster within that framework because it's based on the same technology that will plug your hard drive into your computer. Compact Flash used to be based on the old IDE standard, and that only went up so far. CFast came out when that transitioned into the faster hard drives and SSDs that still plug in via a cable. And so they use that framework. And that I don't think that's going to be upgraded at all because it's all transitioning towards data throughput over PCI Express. And that is what the, was it QXD format originally came out with. But that is changing as well because that format has gotten more evolved. And I think it's the non-volatile memory express NVMe protocol that really amps that up quite a bit, which is what the CF Express card is going to be based on. This is the card that is going to be the successor of CFast and QXD. And the first prototypes are available on the market, or at least being shown off at NAB. There's no cameras right now that can utilize this card, so why would you really buy it? Which is always a problem when you've got these new form factors, is how does it get a foothold in the industry? Are you familiar, Bruce, with who ProGrade is in terms of a manufacturer?
You know, I am not until I had read this article, but, you know, it mentions in there that there's some former Lexar people that are involved in this company. I guess, you know, Lexar was sold
to a Chinese company and they still exist. And they're still manufacturing products. But a lot of the executives decided to form their own company. ProGrade was born. Now, it's not like they're... immediately they've built up their own manufacturing facilities and what have you. I mean, they're getting these cards manufactured by a third party, and I'm sure Lexar was as well. CF Express, let's talk about this. This is the prototype card. The only one that they're showing off is 1 terabyte in capacity, which is huge. I mean, that's the highest that you can find in any memory card format right now on the market or otherwise. But the speed is 1400 megabytes per second, 1.4 gigabytes per second. That is almost three times as fast as the fastest that CFast can get. And that's where this technology is debuting. It's three times fast. Now, I have no possible use for this. But what if you're shooting with a 50 megapixel camera, or, you know, Canon is showing off their prototype 120 megapixel sensor that probably won't make it into a consumer device. But as these resolutions get higher and the engineering of the internal circuitry of cameras can push data through at a faster rate, imagine if you had a 60, 70, 80 megapixel camera that could shoot at 10 frames per second. Or if you were shooting raw video right off of a high resolution sensor, then this makes a huge impact. In fact, the Canon prototype 120 megapixel sensor, we were talking about it a couple of weeks ago.
It
can clock out at 9.4 frames per second at 120 megapixels. Now, that's just a ridiculous amount of data.
Yeah.
Something like this CF Express card would be required in order to record that, unless it's going live into another system somehow for automatic interpretation and, if I could speak, analysis. I've stolen a lot of thunder here. I'm sure you've got some opinions on memory cards and speed and storage and all that, Bruce. So why don't you take it away? What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah. I mean, faster is always better, obviously. This is like insane, the leap that they're you're seeing 3 to 4 times the speed with these CF Express cards. But like anything, you know, like you say, it was just sort of debuted or shown at NAB. And typically, like most stuff that you see at any kind of like CES or NAB or any of these shows, you're usually a year, 2 years or more, maybe before you actually start seeing some of this stuff become more mainstream. So it's one of those things. It's good to know what's coming down the pipe and keeping an eye on it. You know, for the immediate, you know, current use, I wouldn't particularly have a need for it, but I do like the idea of, you know, a larger card. I've always been a bit of a subscriber, particularly now with, you know, with the cameras that have the dual card slots. I've always been a subscriber to, you know, putting all my eggs in one basket. You know, I know some wedding photographer friends who don't want to do that, and they shoot all day on these, you know, two gig cards, or, you know, and they're just constantly like flipping cards. And I say, you run into way more chance of losing one, or, you know, bending a pin, or, you know, these things, than just if you got two, you know, I run with 64 gig cards in my cameras, and I can run, you know, for most of the day. I don't have to worry about switching cards out and
yeah.
confusing cards and things like that. So I'm always a big proponent of, you know, bigger cards and more storage.
I got 256 gig memory cards as well. And yeah, it's as much as I would need in most cases, but I've been continuously upgrading. So I've got a 32, a 64, a 128, mm-hmm. a 256. So I can keep them all handy, you know, if I need, yep. but none of them have ever failed on me. No, knock on wood. Not to say that a card won't fail, because that mm-hmm. does happen. These are not, you know, perfect devices.
Twice I've had that happen.
Oh no. Like yep. a permanent loss of data.
Yep.
Oh,
yep.
geez.
But fortunately, I was shooting dual cards, so I had redundancy.
Good.
So I never knock on wood, I haven't lost any data. I've never lost a client image, because I took the extra steps of making sure it was ready to two cards at the same time. But yeah, I have had two cards over the course of my career that have been unrecoverable.
I've had, you know, a strategy that I typically do is if I'm shooting out in the field for a lengthy period of time, like if I'm traveling or if I'm out in the wilderness for a couple of weeks, and I've done that a few times, what I'll usually do is at the end of a day, I'll download all of the data on that memory card to my Surface Pro 3, mm-hmm. which has a 512 gigabyte internal storage. So that's more than enough to keep all of the data there. And I could even plug in a micro SD card and back it up doubly to that. So then I would have three copies of the data, one on the micro SD card, one on the Surface Pro 3, and then one still on the existing memory card in the camera. Mm-hmm. And there's no reason to wipe that card, because I got a lot of extra space. I'm not worried about running out. So I'm also a proponent of having the higher capacity cards, so long as you're doing something to ensure that your data is protected or redundant in some way, shape, or form. But what really caught my attention here about this new format of memory cards is with a firmware update. And this actually happened to my main computer motherboard. I got a firmware update that allowed it to have a boot logic for NVMe SSDs. So I've got an Intel, what is it, a 750 series plugged into a PCI Express card slot on my machine. It's really fast. Well, there are faster options now, but it is, you know, lightning speed compared to any other technology that you would be able to use there. It was a firmware upgrade that allowed me to use that on my computer. And they're saying that a firmware upgrade on any camera that currently uses the XQD cards will potentially be able to support the new CF Express format. And that's huge in terms mm-hmm. of adoption, because yeah. even if there's no cameras that are purpose-built for CF Express, if Nikon rolls out firmware updates on their flagship cameras that have the XQD cards as a standard function, then immediately you could plug this card into that camera and have it work. That's mm-hmm. not saying that it will be at its full speed, mind you, but at the very least, you'd be able to use these right off the bat, especially at the higher capacity, and have that alongside for when you buy your next camera.
Right. Yeah. So you're kind of future-proofing yourself a little bit in terms of deciding what to buy for your next memory cards and things like that. So
yeah. Now there's no brand recognition in terms of quality for this new pro grade brand. And again, I've been a SanDisk guy, and they've been recently bought by Western Digital, and I have no idea if that affects their quality or where they're manufactured, or you know, how many duds actually get shipped out there, which can change when a company changes hands. Mm-hmm. But I've been happy with them. But I'm keeping a close eye on this, because a company that was just announced that they were information in February of this year Now we're in April, a few months later, and they've got a card that nobody else is offering at speeds we've never heard of before. I think it's something to keep an eye on, too. You know, a great company to potentially invest a little bit of your money in and get a card from them. At least try them out.
It's interesting, even just looking at the first, when I saw the images, I was like, hey, interesting. They chose almost the same color schemes and feel of Lexar.
Exactly.
So they've got kind of the gold branding and some of that, right? So at first glance, if I saw this on the shelf, I would probably just assume it was just it was just like a sub brand of Lexar.
Yeah. Well, hey, you know, more power to them for being able to leverage that brand without getting sued.
Right. Yep.
Exactly. Well, we will see as time continues there. Yeah. Let's talk about the next story here, because this one can branch out into an interesting discussion. Again, we're looking at all the news that came out of NAB show that was happening this week. And I don't know if it's still on, but a lot of these announcements kind of come out before the show, and people can mull over the new products when they visit at the booth.
Maybe for somebody who's listening who doesn't know what NAB is, there maybe not everybody is aware of what the NAB show is. Do you want to maybe give them a little
officially? What is NAB? NAB is no longer an acronym. Okay. You know, if you ask them what NAB show stands for, it stands for NAB show.
Okay.
In fact, I actually forget what it means now, because I've been indoctrinated.
Wasn't it the National Association of Broadcasters?
I think that's what it was. Yeah.
I think.
And so it is the cinema focused, a professional trade show for products, but both shooting, but also reviewing and editing and that whole enchilada. So the next story comes from ISO, if that's how I pronounce it. It might be ISO. I've never had to pronounce ISO it before. But they have always made really high-end monitors, both for professional editing and medical purposes. And I've had a lust for one of these for a long time, because they just look like they're to the nines, as good as you can get. Whether or not you need it, whether or not you need an f/0.95 lens, the number has an allure to it, you know. And I've seen a lot of really soft and badly done images on that, just like I'm sure some pretty crummy movies have been edited on the monitors that ISO or ISO produce. But they've rolled out their latest product, the CG319X, which it's a 4K display, DCI 4K. So that's 4,096 across, not the 3820, I think it is. Mm-hmm. So it's got the full 4K, and it's 31 inches, which my main monitor, by the way, is a 32-inch 4K display. I love screens of that size and of that pixel density. It just tends to work really, really nicely. They have a fame of building in, just kind of flips down from the top or sometimes on the bottom, a calibration unit in the monitor itself. So it takes care of its own calibration system, which is convenient and easy to just do it even every time you sit down, because it's not going to take a lot of time, although that might be a bit excessive. Have you taken a look at these monitors before? Are you familiar with the brand? And these specs are pretty impressive, but does it really matter?
Yeah, I'm familiar with the brand. I don't personally own one of these. I wish that I had a bank account, to afford one like you. I kind of, I've seen them and have lusted after one, but I don't do necessarily the type of, super color. Obviously, with the wedding stuff, we're concerned about the color, and I calibrate my display and I'm happy with my print output, but I'm not, I'm not shooting product photography where it's like, I have to be, it's 100% scientific in terms of the color accuracy.
You have to match some weird neon Pantone color. And
yeah, I'm not living in that world, but definitely looking at these monitors, very, very nice displays for sure. But they come with also a very, very nice price tag as well. So
yeah, they didn't give a price for this one, but if you look at the price of the previous model, it was just under $6,000 US. Here in Canada, that's over $7,000. Yeah. And you know what? That's a bit much for me.
It's getting up there. Yeah,
it's getting up there, especially because I'm using a slightly older version of the Asus ProArt. Was it the PA329? That is just about $1,200 US. Mm-hmm. So it is a significant fraction of the price. Pretty much the same size. Each of them claim 99.something% coverage of the Adobe RGB color space. The Asus ProArt display claims 95% of what was the I'd never heard of it before.
DCI P No, what was it?
Yeah, DCI-P3.
Yeah.
Which, if you actually look at the way these color spaces overlay, it gets into much deeper saturation, almost unusual saturation that you, you know, would have a hard time even recording on a device. And the ASUS display is 95% of that, whereas this display is 98%. So there is, by the numbers, an improvement when you're dealing with the most extremely saturated colors in some color space that you've never heard of and probably have never used before. So at the end of the day, does that make it better? I'm not sure if it does, especially because you can buy a monitor calibrator. Like I've used the from X-Rite, the Color Monkey Photo, yep, as well as their i1 Display Pro, both do a remarkably good job at just resetting a monitor back to what the perfect even standard is. And I only have to calibrate every couple of months or so. Yep. And I usually only do so when I see something deviate a little bit. It's usually pretty accurate for me. Do you calibrate your displays as well, Bruce?
I do. I have. I'm showing it now. It's not video, but it's the. I use the Spider. It's an older one. It's a Spider 3 color calibrator, and it still seems to do the job. I've been kind of holding out. I've been waiting. You know, there's these promises of a new modular Mac Pro coming out. I have an older Mac Pro Tower, one of the sort of the last of the uni, you know, the old aluminum chassis ones, and it's about 7 years old now, and I can still, you know, I've been able to put in an SSD and upgrade the memory and do some things to it to kind of keep it humming along. But I'm still on an older Apple Cinema display. And so I'm ready to jump. I'm ready to move. But when they announced that the 5K iMac Pro, I was tempted. And then I saw the price tag and I was like, I don't know.
I love when you can decouple the monitor from the computer.
Yeah,
I mean, it just gives you a different upgrade path. And to me, like I'm a PC user. I've built my own PCs my entire life, and I love doing that. It's a fun experiment because, you know, if I need a faster graphics card, if I need a faster anything, I can always upgrade it unless I reach the limitations of what the motherboard can support. And then I've got to, you know, reinvest and build a whole new system. But when I buy a monitor, it's easy to get one that, you know, through reviews and other people's testing is very, very high quality and accurate. Mm-hmm. You can get really, really bad displays as well. You know, buyer beware when it comes to buying a cheap television or monitor. Yeah. I know that in my parents' basement, they've got a big, beautiful, it's like a 55, 60 inch TV that has one of the cheapest possible polarizing filters on it. Every LCD screen has a polarizing filter. That's how LCD technology works. And it has a rainbow effect that is noticeably visible when the TV is off. And I asked them how much they paid for it. It's like, oh, we got a great deal on this, like $200.
Yeah.
Like, well, yeah, it shows. You know, I'd never want to make content on a display like that. You can get great monitors at a smaller scale for, you know, $500 to $1,000. If you go up to the 4K 32-inch displays, they're between $1,000 and $1,500. Personally, that's where I think every photographer should be. It's everything that you would need. You don't need to spend the money on one of these gorgeous displays from ISO or ISO. And I look at these devices and I know that that they sell to high-end cinema productions. I've seen some in use. I've seen some in medical establishments as well. And they've got a whole line of products that are at weird aspect ratios that are designed for displaying X-rays or whatever medical equipment requires. And the price tag is there associated with it.
Yeah.
Continue.
Oh, I was going to say somebody in the comments on that article for it linked to yet another monitor that's coming out from a company called Flanders Scientific Inc. And it's a 43 inch, $45,000. If you want,
wow, that's,
you want to talk
that's
about
more than my car.
Spending some money on this is a large format reference monitor. Designed for color critical monitoring of 4K UHD and HD signals. So yeah, 45,000. Sorry,
and they
it's
might
a 31
sell 10
inch.
Of them.
It's 30 inch. Yeah, yeah. Well, not to me.
No. Yeah, let's just make a whole video wall with them. Wouldn't
just
that be wonderful?
Yeah. So who do you think this other one would be aimed at then? Is like you say, kind of the high end cinema.
You're looking at high-end broadcast studios. You're looking at high-end cinema production, you know, Hollywood stuff and what have you, where they're going to be playing in some of these more obscure color spaces because they need to make sure that that color accuracy is as good as possible for mastering the product. When it gets distilled down into the deliverable, you know, a lot of the documentary films that I've worked on in the past, a lot of it was shot at 4K or higher, but they're deliverable to the end customer, whether it be Discovery Channel or National Geographic, BBC. A lot of this stuff is done by third parties and then sent on. The deliverable that they ask for is 1080p. So, you know, you're going to end up narrowing it down to something that is broadcast quality and, you know, streaming quality and what have you, but it's not necessarily going to be the master that you would still retain, you know, and make sure that everything is as accurate as possible, especially for color grading and matching different things. Making sure that those colors are accurate is important. I did notice, and I thought that this was a bit odd, the calibration on these displays is right near the very top. I mean, it's a little flip down thing, and it's very close to the edge of the frame. In some displays, and I'm assuming that it's not the case here, but I would never calibrate at the edge of a display because you might have a little bit of a light bleed of some kind. And I'm sure at a $6,000 price tag, you're not going to have that. They're going to make sure that that doesn't happen. But whenever I calibrate, it's pretty much smack in the middle where everything is going to kind of flow out. And that's where I'm going to be judging the color accuracy of something more often than right off on the very edges of a monitor. But interesting new tech. Fun note though here is, of course, Izo doesn't produce the panel themselves. They manufacture the final product, but they buy the processor from one company, the panel from another, and they make sure that they get the top binned items across the board, especially for their market. But that panel may be something that might not be as high, like AAA graded. It might be AA or single A. I have no idea how they grade these things. But that might be ever so slightly lower. That exact same panel that might be the same quality as in this monitor will be in a much cheaper display. And you'll have to wait for people to take one apart and figure out what panel is being used in this model versus another model. But I think you'll be able to find the same relative quality in something that is half the price, quarter the price, or in that same neighborhood.
Yeah. And maybe it's only hits, you know, 96% instead of 98%.
Right. And so I think you'd still be winning at that point. All right. So it's some fun NAB stuff that kind of came to mind there.
Have you ever been? And have you gone to the show?
I have not. You know, I've been to almost no conferences. And, you know, this is kind of a point of contention to me because I can read these press releases and I can get as much knowledge as I need to get jazzed about a product, to understand if I want to buy it or just to figure out where the industry is going without physically holding it in my hands. Because if I'm talking to somebody at the show, they're probably not even going to be able to tell me anything that's not in the press release. So it just kind of feels like from a gear or a technology announcement perspective, being present at these conferences is not necessary these days. Networking and connecting to individuals, I think, is really what they're all about.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and a lot of times they put out some of this stuff even before the show starts. You get some of this information comes out even beforehand, right? So they try to get out ahead of the masses. So,
right. Well, let's move into the picks of the week section of the podcast. Perfect. And I like to pick something that somewhat relates to the topic that we're talking about. I don't do a whole lot of video that requires audio, interestingly enough, because when I'm shooting for documentary films, they have their own audio track that they'll typically apply over my footage. But for stuff that I've recorded personally, you want to have good audio, and the microphone on your camera is bad. It's the worst. So how do you get good audio, especially on your person, you know, to even be like maybe moving around without having a sound guy there with a big boom mic above you, kind of tracking your movements? Well, Rode, I've used their shotgun microphone before in the past, and I think I still have it around somewhere, and it's worked pretty well for just general use. But I invested in the Rode Link wireless filmmaker kit a few years ago. and it has never failed me. It's got pretty good audio. I mean, for the price, it's $400, and you can add a zero to that for this kind of equipment easily. Yeah. But for the kind of productions that I've done, it's given me clean audio. Very little noise around me comes through. And it has a transmitter and receiver with a wireless lav mic. So yeah, kind of clip it on your belt and then you fish that up through your shirt, you know, clip it on your lapel. And it does a remarkable job. If you look at the reviews, I mean, I bought it from B&H. The reviews are like 4.5 stars with like almost 200 reviews. Everybody just absolutely loves it. Now, I made a mistake and I broke the microphone. It's not that it was poorly built. I abused it horribly. And I bought a Sennheiser replacement because for some reason Rode doesn't sell a specific replacement for the set, but the Sennheiser was not very expensive. It was about $90 or $100. And it got even better quality out of that as a small little upgrade. So nice. You can take this as an entry into high quality audio that blasts away what you would get out of your camera built in, and you know, you don't even really notice these microphones in the scenes. So something to consider if you're ever going to be recording yourself or doing an interview with people on video. This makes all the difference in the world. Good audio surpasses good video when it comes to content consumption.
I don't do a ton of video myself, but I've done a little bit, and I've used a combination of a Zoom H4N recorder, and then I went with the Sennheiser wireless lav mic, which was a little bit more than that when I bought them. So they've probably come down a little bit, you know, like most things, right? So, but yeah, I've heard of this Rodelink filmmaker kit, and it looks good. Now, how much did you say it was for the kit? About $400?
$399 US. Oh,
yeah. So that's good.
And so, I mean, it's not bad. I always buy from B&H because, you know, when it crosses the border, you know, it's free shipping and you pay for the duty in Canada right away. So there's no surprises when it gets to you. And if I were to look that up at a local here in Canada, we've got Henry's or Vistech, and they probably stock it, but you might find it priced at $599 or something. Yeah. And I'm still making a deal. I love to support local, but when the price difference is $100 or more, you know, that's kind of where I draw the line.
Yeah, I'm with you on that too. Yeah, I try to buy local as much as I can, but yeah, it's not very many options anymore, right? There's, like you say, where we are here, we just have McBain and Vistech, and that's, you know, kind of your local places. So
exactly. Right. I'm curious to know what your pick of the week is, Bruce.
So my pick is somewhat video related. So doing a little bit of traveling recently. I mentioned at the top of the show, we just got back from Japan. And prior to that, we actually went to Portugal in November. We went for a month and spent some time kind of in the southern part of Portugal and Lisbon and traveled around a little bit. And I wanted to do some video. I really wanted to kind of get into that. So I brought my SLR and did some other things. I thought, you know, I want to shoot a little bit of video. And I'd been doing a little bit more just with my iPhone, and I've been seeing some pretty incredible, you know, video, just, you know, people making some pretty amazing travel videos just from their iPhone. So I thought, you know what, I want to go a little lighter. And so I started researching the little smartphone gimbals that were on the market. And at the time, you had the DJI had their Osmo mobile one, which is a little smooth gimbal, but it was about $400. And I started looking, and there was a competitor out of China, I never get this name. It's Zhiyun, I think is how you pronounce it. Let's go with it. It's like Ezio, Zhiyun, Zhiyun. My Chinese is not very good. So anyways, they had basically a knockoff of the DJI Osmo, and it was, you know, half the price. It was $200. So I thought, I'm just kind of getting into this. I'm going to try this, and I'm going to pick it up. And it worked great. I took it with me to Portugal and got some really nice, smooth footage. It took, you know, it was a bit of a learning curve just to get used to using the gimbal. And then I came back, and of course, you know, about a month after I came back, DJI announced the Osmo Mobile 2, and it was, you know, some new specs and new things, and it was half the price. So it was now in line with this Zhiyun Smooth Q gimbal that I had purchased. So the one advantage that the DJI has that I kind of would have preferred to go with is it has some nice integration with the Filmic Pro app, which is what I've been using to shoot video on my iPhone. And it's got a lot of nice controls on it. So that would be my kind of recommendation. Now that the price has dropped on it, I would go with the DJI, their Osmo Mobile 2. But the one that I bought was the Zhiyun Smooth Q. Smartphones.
If anybody isn't familiar with what these products do, it's almost like magic. I mean, it it smooths out the shaky handheld video mm-hmm. to be like in camera without any image stabilization technique in the camera itself to be like almost, you know, some sort of voodoo type of technology in there that predicts what motion you're going to make and mm-hmm. counteracts that.
Yeah.
So that it keeps the camera completely solidly still, and you can move around your subject and you can move up and down, and it just smooths everything out for cinematic quality. And, you know, for the cost of that, mm-hmm. a couple of $100s, around, what was the price point now for the new DJI one?
I think the new DJI one is about $200, I want to say. It might even be less than that. Let me look, actually. Let's just see. Oh, you know what? It's $129 US.
Wow.
Yeah.
If you want to up your game in terms of video, then that is a no-brainer.
Yeah.
It's so simple.
So simple, yeah. And it was beautiful. We were on, like, in Portugal, we were on a boat, you know, moving, and it was silky smooth. And there's a little bit of a learning curve, but once you get comfortable with it, it's amazing, the quality. So, if you really want to up your video game just off of your smartphone, and they make other gimbals as well too, obviously DJI and the Zhiyun, and they make other gimbals for smaller, your mirrorless, like your, if you have your GH5 or other, you know, other cameras, you could use them with that too, for not, you know, not a lot of money. So.
Perfect. Well, we'll put a link to both of those in the show notes, just so people can see them both, compare the features, and judge for themselves what's going to suit them best. So thanks for that pick. I think it's really important to open people's eyes to these devices that might not be on their radar, because maybe you're not using your phone for that much video, or at least nothing production-wise, because you don't think it's capable of, when a few little accessories here and there can make a world of difference to get it there specifically.
Yeah, and this thing's light. It travels well, and it gets about 14 hours of battery life. So you could actually use it to charge your phone up if you weren't recording all day. You could use it as a backup to you know, so even for that, it came in handy a couple times when I was out of juice. I could top up my phone from my my gimbal.
That's funny. All right. Well, as we're reaching the end of this episode, Bruce, one of the things that I typically sign off with is just kind of a simple question of where your passions are going to take you next, what the next big idea you have, or I know you're probably going to be gearing up for your wedding season in the next little while. But what keeps those creative juices flowing for you?
Oh boy, that's a good question. Just there's always new stuff. Like, video has been something that has been an interest of mine for the last little while, and I've started to kind of delve into it a little bit more. The last couple of years, I've done a little bit of hybrid video. So I've done some stills and then done a little bit of shooting a little bit of video alongside the stills for a wedding, and put together a bit of a hybrid style. So I've been kind of toying with that a little bit and trying to learn a little bit more about, you know, I've been learning, video editing and starting to get, you know, a little bit better than that. I'm still banging rocks together compared to somebody that's been at it for a while, but you know, I'm getting there. And then just with my own travel stuff, I've been, Portugal and Japan, we've shot a lot of video that been kind of working on. So that's been kind of fun. That's been kind of pushing me the last little while, but obviously, like you say, wedding season's coming up here fairly soon. So then we get back into the grind of wedding season for the next few months. So some of those passion projects take a bit of a backseat until it's winter again.
Right. You know, a quick question about the wedding stuff too. Mm. Again, it's outside of my wheelhouse, so I'm curious about it. Whenever you do a wedding, I'm sure you've got the traditional shots that are must-haves, right? And you talk to your clients about, you know, what pairings of people you need to get photos of in more of a traditional, structured kind of sense. But what do you do sort of creatively off the beaten path, something that might not work as a photograph, but it's a creative risk? Do you do a lot of that and then say, okay, Martha, whoever the person is, would you like to indulge me for a moment? I'm going to try to do something unusual. It might turn into a complete failure, but it might be a fun success, or at least an interesting memory. How many of those moments do you try to incorporate in your shoots?
It obviously varies depending on the wedding day and how much time we have. I mean, oftentimes wedding days are pretty, you know, your timetables are pretty compressed. You don't have a lot of time sometimes to experiment. But a couple of things that we've done, we love to play with off-camera flash. And so if we can, at some point in time during the evening or even during the day, we'll try to bust out the flashes and do something kind of creative, even if we're in kind of a drab, less than interesting venue. Something I picked up the Magmod system, which is basically attachments you can put on your flashes that you can easily take gels and other, you know, grids and other modifiers. So we've been playing with that a little bit and seeing what we can create, you know, just from a bare wall. And can we do something interesting? I've been doing a bit of that. Played a little bit around with some double exposure stuff. That's been kind of cool just to see what we can get with some double exposures. I always like to try to do some silhouettes if I can. It's always fun. I love reflections. So those are some of the things that I try to incorporate one of or two of those at some point in the wedding day if we get the opportunity or get the time. So
just to keep things interesting.
Yeah, right? There's always something, right? There's always something we get to play. And a lot of times it's dictated by the environment and the location. Sometimes the location will just, there's something there that you have to do something epic with because the location screams that you got to do something epic with what you're given in the environment, right? So
exactly. Well, if people are interested in your services, either as a wedding photographer or portrait photographer or any of the wonderful types of images you can create, where can people find you?
Sure, yeah. Best place is probably over on my website, which is just momentsindigital.com. You'll find me hanging out there, our blog. And then if they want to follow me on social media, I am at Bruce Clark on Twitter and Instagram, Facebook, and that's Clark with an E. So I guess when it comes to being the one and only Bruce Clark, I managed to get those.
Well, we will put all those links in the show notes so that you can check out Bruce's work and keep in touch with him. And for me at Photo Geek Weekly, it's photogeekweekly.com where you will find those show notes. And there are links to all of my personal social media accounts where you can see what I'm up to lately there. And just before we sign off, I want to give a big thank you to, of course, every listener, but those listeners that have put a little bit in the tip jar. It's always great to have a few extra dollars there to cover the production costs and hosting costs of the website. And there is a link on the website. If you enjoy the content, maybe I'll spend a little bit of that on a coffee, stay caffeinated for these conversations as well, improve the content therein because of it. And I think a while ago, I made a recommendation on my picks of the week for Folding at Home, which is a distributed computing platform that will help, you know, cure cancer and mad cow disease and Parkinson's, or potentially develop research that will lead in that direction. And you can lend your computer processor to that effort. And a number of people listened. You know who you are, and I've got your names in the roster of people that are contributing to my team for that. And I'm very, very happy. I've got a bright and happy heart to see that people took that recommendation and are contributing to that that service. So thanks for that. And I guess that's all I have. So Bruce, we sign off by saying, you know, it's been an hour. You've been listening to us. So now it's best that you get out and shoot.